Good afternoon. Hello. So hopefully you're all here for 3330. If not, hopefully you don't mind being here for 3330. So I'm Charles Rice. You may notice I'm not the person who's listed as your instructor. That's Samira Khan back there. We will be co-teaching both lecture sections of 3330. So some days I will do both sections, and some days Samira will do both sections. To start out, I will be doing both sections. I did the 11 a.m. one, so it should be the same as this. And to start out, we'll go through sort of a high-level overview of things we're going to cover in this course, which is about computer architecture. It's about how hardware works. So we're going to look at, in fact, not just hardware, but all the layers of abstraction. And you've kind of seen these before. Well, most of these, not all of these. So we'll be using a high-level language like C or C++. In this course, we happen to have chosen C. We'll be working from that down to the assembly that it's compiled into. In this course, we'll be using 64-bit x86. Which I assume most of you have seen in 2150. Some of you may have seen 32-bit x86. If so, the differences are pretty minor and will hopefully catch you up. We'll be working with machine code, and you would naively expect me to list x86 64 again, because why would we use a different assembly than machine code? But it turns out that we'll use a sort of simplified version for this course. And with that machine code, we'll also explore how we do whatever it is that actually implements that machine code. That's going to be a majority of this course. So for some of the course at the beginning, we'll be talking about some stuff with C and some stuff with producing assembly. And later on in the course, this will come up again. But for most of the course, we'll be talking about these pieces, how we actually implement that machine code and what that machine code is, how we make the hardware to do it. And the components that eventually we work with are sort of gates, transistors, wires, and registers. And we won't go into that much detail on those in this course. We'll work at a slightly higher level, which I'll discuss later. But ultimately, we're going to somehow take gates, transistors, and these sort of basic hardware components and build something that interprets our machine code. And that's going to be assignments you have in this course. You won't actually be building physical hardware, but we'll be working in sort of a programming language for writing hardware, similar to what people actually use in the real world, since they usually don't actually lay out transistors like on a grid. That's not a practical way to build a billion transistor processor. So, let's start out with our first level of abstraction, that higher level language. So as I said, we're using C. I think you've seen C before, barely. So C, it's almost a subset of C++. So it just has some less features. So there's no classes, there's no new delete, there's no IO streams, so it's just simpler. It turns out there are some other changes, so it's not properly a subset. It's not the case you can just take some C code and run it as C++ all the time, but it's pretty close. And this means that essentially, because you've done a lot of programming in C++, I think, you should already know C, most basically. And the next few lectures, we'll talk about some things which are different and some things which exist in C++ that you probably didn't see very much that we want you to learn for this course that are helpful to know for hardware and for other reasons. So why are we using a high-level language in this course? Like, logically, we're dealing with building hardware, and hardware doesn't execute C. Hardware executes assembly. Why do we bother with this higher level of abstraction? Why don't we just stay below that level and just work with assembly? And the main reason is that C is a convenient way for us to think about assembly. That there's a fairly direct correspondence from some C code to some assembly code. That I can look at C code and translate it to equivalent assembly code, even by hand, fairly easily. So this is straightforward, and it's easier to look at C code and see what it does and then think about transplanting little bits of it to assembly and think about how the hardware would execute it than it is to have some bunch of assembly where you have, say, no variable names because it's all registers and all that. So we'll just find it easier to work in C to talk about what our hardware's doing. And that's the reason we're using it in this course, not because it's a great language for writing low-level programs, but because we have this direct correspondence to assembly and you basically already know it. So this should help you understand the machine just because it's going to be easier to think about what assembly does if you're thinking about sort of the high-level view of the equivalent C code. But a caution. So while there's a straightforward way for me to translate C into assembly, or vice versa, this doesn't mean it's what your compiler does. So your compiler might do that, and sometimes will do that. Sometimes will do this straightforward translation. But your compiler might be clever. And this is particularly common with optimizing compilers. You pass the minus O fast to flag to GCC, meaning please try to make my code really fast. And GCC might do some things which are clever, which are not obvious. And I did want to tell you about this, not because it's useful to think about doing those clever things yourself, but because you might be surprised by what your compiled code does. It might not match the model we give you in this course, because the model we give you in this course is going to be based on this direct correspondence. And if your compiler does something clever, it could behave in a different way. So since we're using C, you should be able to run C programs and compile them. And sort of the first informal assignment, you won't be have something for you to submit, but you should do, is be able to do this. So you need to be able to compile C programs somewhere. And in fact, we also need to be able to compile programs in the programming language D, because there's a tool we'll use later in this course. So on the course website, linked on the day before today, there's instructions for doing this, for setting up an appropriate environment. And you should just do that before the next lab. And there are lots of options. So probably one of the most popular options is we'll give you lab accounts. You should get them around this weekend for the Unix lab machines. And a common thing people do is SSH into those machines and do all their work there. That is perfectly acceptable. And that's sort of our baseline. If you have trouble like getting things working on your own machine, that's what we're going to tell you to do. We're not going to try to debug why your machine with its Snowflake configuration doesn't work. It's not worth our TA time. Other options are that you can use a Linux environment. We have a few assignments which actually depend on Linux, so a native or VM Linux environment will work for essentially all the course, or there's some online IDEs which give you a Linux environment remotely that you can access through a web browser. These are all things that people have had success with, but you just should have a way to do it before the first lab, which you have to do on a 64-bit Linux machine or it won't work. And the most common option, I said, is the lab accounts, which are a valid solution. But if you have something else that's more convenient for you, that's perfectly fine. So as I said, our supported platform is the lab machine. Many people in practice use laptops. And for most of the assignments, not all of them, you can even use not Linux. Like OS X natively works for many people for most but not all assignments. And there's some assignments where I give a caution. So for most assignments, Linux on a VM is great. But we have some assignments coming up later in the semester where we have you measure performance. And VMs run a little slower, a little differently. That's going to mess up performance measurements. We don't recommend using VMs for those assignments. That will come up much later in the semester. So you should at least be able to use lab accounts if that comes up. Since there will be a few cases where you want to do that, even if you want to have a primary environment, which is a VM on your laptop. So any questions about computing environments? Okay. So move on. So that's about our computing environment requirement. So that's first to-do. We'll get to some more to-dos for you later. But let's move on down our stack. So I talked about C and the environment for building C and running and debugging C programs that you'll need. And we also mentioned that we're using assembly. And we're going to have you actually use x86-64 assembly. And in theory, you all know this. Well, most of you know 32-bit, but that's very close. In reality, we're not so sure. You may, if you look at the schedule, you see we have a day for assembly. So we probably don't really believe you know it, because your introduction in 2150 is pretty brief, so we'll go over this some more. But this is what we're going to use in this course as our primary assembly language, and you're going to make a processor which handles some part of x86 64 assembly. So for those of you, who here has seen, had 2150 with 32-bit assembly? Okay, so like 5-10%. So for those of you, the course has since changed to 64-bit if you don't know, but fortunately for our purposes, the differences are pretty small. The biggest thing is that there's more registers and they're bigger. That is essentially all you need to know. You can look up in your textbook in chapter 3, there's the table of registers. You can look that up for a refresher. That should be what you need to know. There's some other differences, but they aren't likely to come up in this course. So any questions about what you need to know for assembly? Okay. So that's our requirements for assembly. So you should know it. And you'll have to use it. And we're going to go the next layer down. So in 2150, you saw machine code for a toy machine, which somehow gives you this binary representation. And here I go in sort of hexadecimal representation for this add instruction here. Now, we could use real x86 64 machine code, but we're not going to do that. So instead, what I'm showing you here is the machine code for that in Y86, which is something our textbook hat uses. It's a sort of a different machine code and a subset of x86 64 assembly. So it doesn't have all the thousands of instructions, literally thousands of instructions that exist in x86 64. It just has like 13. And while it's really useful to have all those thousands of instructions when you're writing assembly, it gives you lots of options, lots of things are much more convenient, this is not so useful for what you'll be doing for most of the class, which is making a processor that implements it. If we had you implement 1,000 instructions, you would not like this course and also probably not pass. So we're using this subset with about 13 or 14 instructions. It's also much simpler than the 64-bit x86 encoding. So x86 has a lot of history. So back in the 80s, there was the 8086, which gave rise to the 286, and then the 386, and the 486. And the 8086 was a 16-bit processor. It had 8 registers, 4 of which were sort of general purpose registers, and 4 of which were special, like accumulator sort of things like you saw briefly in 2150. And it had an encoding for this, a machine code for these 16-bit registers, 4 of which were special, 4 of which were not. And then Intel decided that they wanted to support 32-bit. And the way they did this is by extending that machine code to make all the registers general purpose and add other things, but without breaking the old 16-bit machine code. They wanted to keep it the same otherwise, so their processor would do the same thing. And then later on, AMD decided that, people making servers, they want 64-bit support, but they still want to run all their 32-bit x86 stuff. So they made a 64-bit extension of x86. And to do this, they kept all the machine code the same as the 32-bit stuff. They just added some stuff to make it 64-bit and to add 8 extra registers. So all the machine code for the 32-bit is exactly the same. Well, kind of exactly the same. So this means that the x86 machine code is very complicated and not for a very interesting reason. There's all this history in that we went the same way where we encoded push AX, AX the name of one of the registers that 8086 had, to be the same now as it was before, even though back when they made that original encoding, there were only 8 registers to push. So we're not going to deal with this complication. And the way we're going to do that is that our book made their own encoding for that was designed to, for 64-bit originally, so it doesn't have all these historical artifacts. But these real processors, they want to be compatible with the old code, so they didn't change the encoding very much. Now, it's not the case that you can take a 16-bit program, a program written for the 8086, and just run it as a normal executable. That doesn't work. Because it turns out that some of the instructions do different things, like pushing uses 64 bits instead of 16 bits. But it's close enough that the processor implementation is similar. And even my laptop's processor, I can put in a mode where it will execute that 8086 code. But I just can't execute it the same mode I execute my normal programs. But because of all that compatibility, real x86 encoding is very complicated, and we won't talk about it, but we'll use something simpler. Now, this is not as simpler as the toy machine code you saw in 2150. So there's several big differences. So the probably the most notable difference is that this is a variable length encoding. Instructions are going to be from 1 to 10 bytes. They're not just going to be fixed size, which is going to complicate things. But this is what real x86 and some of our processors do. Also, we're going to have our full register set. It turns out we're going to have 15 registers, not 16. So all the instructions will have two operands. They can operate on two registers, each of which are chosen from the full 15. And we'll have all our full conditional jumps. And we're going to have some pretty complicated instructions, like stack manipulation, like push and pop. Those are pretty complicated instructions versus anything you saw in the machine code in 2150. And you're going to have to implement them in sort of our hardware description language. So any questions about Y86 at this high level? OK, so that's our machine code. And most of the course is going to be at this level, the whatever implements that machine code. The thing that's built on top of gates, transistors, wires, and registers, and these other sort of components that let us build a circuit that takes that machine code and turns it into a processor. That's most of our semester. And most of you are probably taking this course mainly because you were told that you're required to take this course to get your CS degree. And many of you may legitimately wonder, why should I care? I'm not going to ever build hardware. I just want to make software. Why are you making me make hardware designs that we can't even put in real hardware quite? How is this useful to me? And I'd like to tell you our motivations for trying to teach you hardware and things that we hope that this course is geared so you can get something out of it, even if your goal is not to actually build a processor, which very, very few of you will be in a position to do. So one of the biggest things, and something which is going to come up all throughout the semester, is program performance. So if you write programs, sometimes you might care whether or not they're fast. And to know whether your program is fast or not, you need to think about what the hardware is doing. So what's a simple way where knowing about the hardware will help you understand how a program will perform? Anyone, any volunteers to proposal? Yes?
If your CPU has a lot of cores, it might work better for multiple.
Yeah, so your CPU might expose ways you can do multiple things in parallel with multiple cores. And if you and to get good performance, you need to know about that and be able to take advantage of it. Anything else? Yes?
Multiple levels of cache and just location of memory.
Yeah, so we'll talk about later in the course that having things be reused. Our CPUs are designed to use data over and over again. And it's much, much faster if you do that. Any other ideas about why? Yeah.
To design an algorithm which uses fewer cycles in hardware.
OK, so we're talking about using cycles. So what makes something use a cycle?
Like in a data path. adding and pushing for some instructions.
So you're talking about like what instructions you're doing? So yeah, so one model is that if we know what the instructions are, maybe that will help us reduce the number of instructions better than if we didn't know exactly what was an instruction and what wasn't. I think it's probably good enough. So the simplest model for program performance is that precise one about sort of what instructions are. So one model for thinking about programs, and an obvious reason why knowing about assembly might be helpful, is that one instruction is one time unit. And a way to make your program faster is to make it execute less instructions. And this is usually true. But modern hardware goes surprisingly far from this sort of naive rule, which is used to be true to a first approximation, that one instruction takes about one unit of time, that you want to just count instructions. So instructions take variable amounts of time, and we're going to reason about ways to improve performance in this class, primarily by dealing with two big issues we're going to talk about that affect your program's performance beyond just the number of instructions. We'll also talk briefly about ways of reducing the number of instructions you have, and certainly knowing whether your three-line C program compiles into like a 100 instruction assembly snippet or a 3 instruction assembly snippet is useful, but not so much something beyond knowing assembly. But there are two big issues which will come up all over this class which affect your performance. So one of those is parallelism. So we mentioned multiple cores, and that's one form of parallelism that it turns out we won't actually deal with very much in this course. But hardware uses parallelism everywhere. Fast hardware is very parallel, and hardware is parallel by default. If you have two wires, it's not the case that one wire works and then the other. They're always working all the time. So hardware can't stop being parallel, and fast hardware takes advantage of this. But in order for you to using this fast hardware to get good performance, you need to make sure that you give the hardware multiple things it can do at the same time. And this is going to matter even when we're running a single program that's a single thread. And when we have you build a processor for y86, you're going to build a processor that does 5 things at a time, 5 instructions at a time. And as a programmer, knowing when the hardware can do multiple things you're requesting at the same time or not is going to really matter. So on a modern processor, the difference between executing one instruction at a time and executing multiple instructions in parallel is something like 20x, 15 to 20x. Speed up. Maybe more. Maybe 30. It's pretty big. So a lot of your processor's good performance is because your processor can execute multiple instructions at once. It can do this, it can find work from different instructions to do at the same time. And we'll talk about how that works and how you as a programmer can make sure that that's happening. And this is important, even if you're writing in a very high-level language, there are things you can do to make it more likely that the hardware will be able to find this parallelism. Another big topic we're going to talk about later in the semester is caching. So processors are much faster when you access recently used things. It's designed for accessing things over and over again. If you have a lot of data and you only access it once, that's going to be much slower than if you have a little bit of data you access over and over again, then you access another little bit of data over and over again. You just scan over the data and don't reuse things, reuse data or reuse code, things will be a lot slower. When I said with parallelism, it's like 20x. With caching, the difference between accessing things which you didn't recently access and accessing things you recently accessed is like 1000x. It's a lot more. And more so than parallelism, caching is something that even in a very high-level language, you can design your programs to take advantage of, And we'll have exercises later in the semester where you're going to restructure programs to do that better. So by knowing how the hardware caches data, when accessing data is fast versus slow based on when you last used it, you can make your program a lot faster, even if you're doing the same calculation. And this is orthogonal to all that big O stuff you've probably done. So asymptotic complexity, yeah, it matters. But this is stuff that improves in addition to asymptotic complexity, because this is improving that constant. And when that constant can improve from, you know, 20 or 1,000 to 1, that's going to be a big deal. So any questions on these sorts of performance benefits? Okay, so program performance is a pervasive topic we're going to be thinking about throughout the semester. So we'll also learn things which matter, even if you think you're never going to write code where you care about the performance, really. You're, you know, I write all my code in Python. I assume it's like way slower than it ever could sensibly be already. Why would I care? So even if you're in that spot, we think you'll learn some useful things, because we're going to talk about what compilers are, how compilers and that tool chain linkers and all those components work. So this is useful because, hey, sometimes you get weird compiler and linker errors, and those are going to be easier to understand, easier to fix, if you know what's actually going on. What does the linker's input actually look like? What sort of assembly is my compiler actually trying to generate? Why does it have this weird behavior? Why does my code, which does something with pointers, do something wrong? What is the compiler doing? You think you'll learn things that are useful, and for debugging, or if you have error problems with the compilers themselves. And also, this is obviously useful if you plan on making a compiler at some point, which some of you might do. So we're also going to talk about sort of weird program behaviors. Because we're talking about how we run programs, we're going to talk about what the hardware does to run programs and what the hardware does when bad things happen. So who here has had a program seg fault? Yep, everyone. So segmentation faults are an example of this. So we're going to learn later in the semester what a segmentation fault really is. And this is all about how the hardware helps the operating system interact with programs. So we're going to talk about the hardware facilities for letting operating systems run your program in a controlled way. And one of those controlled ways is that you get a seg fault when you access memory you're not supposed to. That's a hardware feature. So we're going to talk about how the hardware implements that. And it also interacts with the operating system, because the hardware sends a signal to the operating system and lets the operating system run. And we're going to talk about that mechanism. And understanding that mechanism is useful if you get seg faults and want to know in more detail what's going on. How can I figure out where this seg fault is? Am I getting things where I'm not getting seg faults, but I should be? And it also should be very useful if you ever want to, say, write an operating system, because you'll need to know exactly about that, those mechanisms the hardware provides for you as an operating system author to control what programs do, to make programs get seg faults instead of doing something dangerous to the machine. So any questions about any of the reasons you should be happy to be taking this course, even if you don't care about hardware? Okay, so let's move on to a completely different topic. So we're going to be dealing with numbers of bytes in this course a lot, and usually those are powers of 2. They're powers of 2 because if you have an address, it's helpful to have a power of 2 number of things for that address. Otherwise, you have addresses which don't map to anything. So we're going to have lots of powers of 2 later on in this course, enough so that we think it is helpful for you to memorize powers of 2 and how to convert to them. So in particular, you should try to memorize these first 10 powers of 2, 1 to 512. I think it will be useful. It's not required, but I think it will save you time and be a skill that you will use surprising amounts in the future. We're also going to use this shorthand for bigger powers of 2. So you've seen like 1K, 4K. that sort of pseudo SI notation, and we're going to use that. So K, we're going to use to represent 2 to the 10, about 1,000. M for 2 to the 20, about 1,000,000. And G for 2 to the 30. So you'll notice that I've given sort of an alternative here, KI, MI, or GI. So K is usually kilo. And some people who really care about being precise about whether they mean 1,000 or 1,024 use kiba, KI. And you might see that sometimes. I'd like to let you know about that. In this course, when we use capital K in a number of bits or bytes, we always mean 1,024. When you use capital M, we always mean 2 to the 20, and so on. We're never going to use powers of 10. In most areas of CS, that's the case. A notable exception is networking, where sometimes they really mean 10 to the third instead of 2 to the 10. But in this course, it's always going to be 2 to the 10. So if we write 4k, we mean 4 times 2 to the 10th. So something to note is that, conveniently, 2 to the 10 is about 10 to the third. And 2 to the 20 is about 10 to the sixth. And so you can say that 2 to the 11th is 2 times 2 to the 10th. That we have a 1 that's our k, and a 1 which is our 2. So 2k is 1, 1. K is 1. And 2 to the 13th, similarly, is 2 to the 3rd times 2 to the 10th. So that's 2 to the 10th is k, and 2 to the 3rd is 8. So that's 8k. Which means that we can basically read off this first digit here as the prefix. So if it's if we have 2 to the 1 something, that's 2 to the something k. If we have 2 to the 3 something, that's something g. This means that you can fairly easily convert from a power of 2 to this shorthand notation like 2g without actually doing like real calculation, without dividing numbers like this. And this will be very useful because on an exam, we're going to be perfectly happy if you write 64k and not 65,536. And you're going to probably be a lot happier writing 64k and not trying to multiply 16,384 by 2 and miscarrying something and getting the wrong answer and having us mark your test question wrong. So, to start you off, let's do an exercise. So here are some powers of 2. So write them out and compare your answers with your neighbor. That is where values are. Okay, who has answers to all of them? This portion, who has answers to at least one of them? Okay, so most people. Anyone want to go over the answer to the first one? Volunteers? Apparently not. Okay, yeah.
It would be 32G.
32G, so how did you get that?
Okay, so 2 to 30 is G, and then you're going 2 to the 5 times that, which is 32.
Okay, yeah, so exactly. So we take our first digit, and that tells us the suffix. So this 3 is G in this case. And then we have remaining 5, and you should be happy to memorize 2 to the 5th is 32, or you could figure that out by hand. It's less tedious than figuring out 2 to the 35 by hand. And you get 32G. How about the second one? What's the answer? 2M. So we have that 2 at the beginning, that tells us that we have M for 2 to the 20, about a million. And then 2 to the 1 is 2. 2 to the 0 would be 1. So the procedure basically is you look at the first digit, that tells you which suffix you use, then you look at the remaining digit, and you either compute the appropriate power of 2 or you've memorized the table, which is not that hard to do. And notably, when you have one digit, this is not look up the SI symbol for 9, for 10 to the 3 times 9. That's not what you do. This is one digit. That's just 512 right in the table. Don't make that mistake. And for 2 to the 14, it's a similar thing. So this had G, M, and here's an example with K. So K is 2 to the 10, and 2 to the 4 is 16, so that's 16K. So as you might guess from forward being on this slide, you should also be able to do this backwards, because we might tell you you have a 32 gig memory, and you might need to know how many of something smaller fits in that and do the division for which it would be helpful to convert back to a power of 2. So as a second exercise, figure out which power of 2, 2 to the what? Each of these are. T is tera. Comes after giga.
Guys, that's 40.
Okay, seems quiet-ish, so I assume some people have answers. So who wants to go over the answer to the first one? Okay? And how did you get that?
1G is 2 to the 30, 16 is 2 to the 4, so we just add them together.
Okay, exactly. So we see G, so we know that's times 2 to the 30, then we just need to figure out what power of 216 is. Now, if we've memorized our table, that's 2 to the 4. You could also figure it out by dividing by 2 until you run out of number. How about the second one? Yeah.
2 to the 17.
17, and you got that because?
That's 1K is 2 to the 10, and 128 is 7.
Okay, yeah. So 128, that's 256 is what you can fit in a byte. So that's 8 bits, so 8. Bits, so 7 would be 2 to the 128, half that. And then K is 2 to the 10, so we got 2 to the 17. And you can use a similar procedure for all of these, where you turn whatever the suffix is into 2 to the appropriate multiple of 10, and then figure out what power of 2 the beginning is, assuming it's a power of 2. And yes, some people were a bit surprised to see T. So T is tera, it comes after giga. We're not going to require you to, you know, memorize Terra probably, but it comes up sometimes. But if you write 1024G on a test, I'm not going to care that you didn't write 1T. So any questions about powers of two and converting between these different notations for powers of two? Okay, so let's go further down the stack. We'll skip over machine code a bit and talk about whatever this thing which implements the machine code is like. So this, as I said, is what we're going to be spending most of the semester on, is how we build the thing that runs machine code. And typically, the thing we think of is a processor. So the machine code is in some memory, and the processor is somehow connected to that memory. And we'll call the connection a memory bus. And what the processor is going to do is it's going to send an address to the memory of some data it would like from the memory, and it's going to get back or send some data with that. So, and this conceptually is just what a processor does. Am I missing anything on this picture? Does a processor do anything more than just talk to memory and send addresses and send data and receive data? Anything else we need in our computer? Yes?
Input and output?
Input and output. So this computer is a computer. The processor will read memory, compute something, and read and write memory based on that. So it's a computer. It's not a very useful computer because it turns out that we, we're limited to what's in memory initially. And we're just going to do a fixed computation. It doesn't let us actually interact with the world, doesn't let us type things. So we'd like to add input-output devices. And the simplest way to do this is to just add them to the same connection. That will add what's sometimes called an I/O bridge on that connection. And so the processor will talk to an I/O bridge and either talk to memory or I/O devices through that. And the simplest way to do this is that we have the exact same interface. The processor sends an address on its output, and the I/O bridge decides, is that I/O or is that memory? And either sends it to I/O devices or receives something from an I/O device, or talks to memory just like in our previous picture. So the interface is exactly the same, and the processor is still just something which talks to this output with an address, gets something back, or sends something to put in that address. It's just that some of those addresses represent I/O devices. That's how our computer actually does useful work, that we can talk to these I/O devices. So our typical operation with our now probably usable computer is that our processor is going to send an address and first to retrieve what instruction it's going to run. And we talked about machine code, and this is where we're going to get machine code from the memory, which isn't going to look like text, but I'm representing as text because that's a lot easier to understand. We're going to get back that machine code, and then the processor is going to do what that machine code says. And in this case, it's a push instruction, so it's going to talk to memory again as part of executing that. And when it's done, it's going to request the next bit of machine code and keep going. It's just going to do this in a loop. And that's what you're going to be implementing later in the course. We'll give you a way of describing hardware, and you'll talk to a memory we give you and send addresses and get back data. And those addresses will be the addresses of a machine code, and you'll interpret that machine code, do what it says, and then, possibly access memory again, and then get the next bit of machine code. And I mentioned that we have the same interface for I/O. So sometimes the CPU will run an instruction that talks to an I/O device. And this is going to look the same basically as reading or writing memory. It's just that we're going to request an address that the I/O bridge has decided is an I/O device. And instead of getting back a value in memory, we'll get back, for example, the key I just pressed on the keyboard. We're not going to go in too much detail about how I/O works, but I want to give you this high-level picture that to get I/O, you don't really need much more than the interface to memory, that we can do it that way. Sort of any questions about sort of what our processor is actually doing and how we're talking to different devices? Okay, so this is sort of the high-level view of what you'll be implementing. We'll talk about the components used to implement that. So we implement our processors that interpret this machine code, and we're going to do it in terms of our circuit tools. So gates, transistors, wires, and registers. And in this course, we're going to be speaking at a high level for circuits. We're not going to deal directly with transistors. We're not going to have you build adders. We're going to deal at a higher level of abstraction, because we care about not how the processor does math, but how the processor figures out what instructions to run and things like that. But we're going to need to talk a bit about some of these low-level components. I'm going to start with wires. So I'm going to often draw wires as a line, and a line with a value, usually 0 or 1 for a single wire. And this is not really carried on the wire. The wire, if you look at it in a microscope, is not going to have a 0 or 1 there. It's going to have a voltage. That's typically how we're going to represent a value on a wire. So for example, we might represent 1 as 3 volts and 0 as 0 volts versus some reference. And conceptually, as far as we're concerned, the entire wire always has the same value. No matter where we are on the wire, it has the same value. If part of the wire is 0, the whole wire is 0. In reality, the value just propagates down the wire. The voltage equalizes, and there's a small delay. For the most part, we won't worry about that delay, but sometimes it will come up a little bit. So these wires deal with single bits. That's useful, but we're often going to want to deal with bigger values. We talked about 64-bit x86. If I have 64 bits of stuff, I do not want to be drawing 64 wires on my slides. You do not want to be typing 64 lines to deal with a 64-bit register. And you won't be doing that. So we're going to bundle these wires together. So here we have some sort of value represented, which that might be the wrong value. Hopefully that's the value I thought it was. That is not 26, is it? I messed up in revising this. Well, or it's probably 26 the other way. Okay. 26, where this is the most significant bit. And flip that. Okay, so we'll take this bunch of wires and treat it as a bundle of wires. So we'll say that we'll just have a bundle of wires which hold a 5-bit value, and we'll just write what that 5-bit value happens to be right now. And so we'll often deal with these bundles of wires rather than a single wire at a time. And in fact, we're going to do more than that. We're just going to draw a single wire and pretend it has a multi-bit value. What we actually mean is we have this bundle of wires with a single value, with different values on each line representing that single value. And this is going to be much more convenient, because if I have a wire holding the value, I want to have a conceptual wire holding the value of a register, that's a lot easier to think about than 64 wires holding each bit of the register. Most of the time, you want to think about in terms of a wire holding a value, not 64 wires that we all have to manipulate all together. So we're going to deal with these bundles of wires. And this is one of our key building blocks. A lot of what you'll be doing is taking components and wiring them together. You won't be doing it with physical wires. You'll be doing it with a programming language for building hardware. But that's sort of the idea, is that you declare wires and you connect things to wires. And your wires are actually going to be these wire bundles, these multi-bit wide things. And we'll just call them wires just because that's convenient. Any questions on these? Okay, so in addition to having wires to carry values between places, we want to actually do computations. And I'll start with the simplest way to do computations, which is gates, which some of you have seen before, some of you may have not. So who can tell me what this is called, this symbol means? Anyone? Yes. So that's an XOR gate. So it computes XOR, which is 1, if exactly one of the inputs is 1. So this is an example of a logic circuit. So we have a wire, 2 wires of input, and a wire of output. And the output is going to change when the input changes. So the simplest way of thinking about it is as soon as we change the input, the output changes to whatever the result of the computation is. The computation here is that XOR function is exactly 1 value 1. In reality, there's going to be a little propagation delay, a little bit of a delay, but it's mostly not going to matter for us. We're mostly going to think of this as doing a computation instantaneously. And I'm talking about gates because they're sort of the simplest form of logic you can have. This takes, it computes a function of 2 bits. There are not many possible functions of 2 bits. But it's actually useful and a building block that we could use, but we'll be generally working at a higher level. So we have this logic which acts like something where we put in the value, get out a value. We're going to generalize that. We want to do more general calculations. So I'll often just say we have a wire which actually holds a multi-bit value, and I put it through some logic which will do a computation like that gate did a computation, where we'll take an input and in sort of instantaneously produce an output on the wire based on the input. And that's going to be some function of 12. And it can be whatever mathematical function we like. We can just say we can make that circuit. And in this class, we're not going to worry about how we actually build that logic, assuming that it's actually a function and not like, you know, not going to output something that's not a number. We're just going to say that you can build that, and we're going to assume that, you know, you can write this in a high-level language and not worry about how that actually gets translated into transistors. So we're going to build things from these high-level building blocks where where you'll have a bunch of logic that you're not going to care about how you actually build that. But the idea is that it takes some input on a wire and produces an output on a wire after some very short delay. So as the input changes, this output is going to change with some delay that's usually negligible. And the output might be a different width than the input. So with the XOR gate, we had a 2-bit input and a 1-bit output. And for these functions in general, that can be true. We can have something which takes 2 32-bit numbers and outputs 1 32-bit number, so it's a different width. You can have something which takes a 32-bit number and outputs a single bit. That's perfectly fine. That's a sort of logic we might have. And this is the level of abstraction we'll deal with that. I'm going to just draw a blue box and say, that works. I'm not going to worry about implementing it. If you want to worry about that, that's a different course. So any questions about logic? OK. So let's go through an example circuit here. So this is, let's say we have some logic which takes a number on this wire and adds 1. And let's say initially at time 0, this wire has the value, has this 3 bits wide and has the value 0, 0, 0. What's going to happen? Any proposals? Yes. Right. So what's going to happen before that? Okay, so we're going to go to 001, then 010, and so on, and then we're going to go to 111 and loop around. That's your proposal. Any other ideas about what's going to happen? Everyone thinks that that's what's going to happen? So that's a reasonable idea, that we'll just keep going up and then eventually we'll loop around. I didn't show that, but that's exactly what you think would happen. But it turns out that that's not the case. The problem is this circuit isn't stable. And there's multiple ways of thinking about why this is the case. So one problem is that there are transient values during changes. When we're transitioning from 001 to 010, it is very likely that we will have 011 or 000 be the value on the wire at some instant. And that's going to make our add one circuit maybe output 011 plus 1 instead of 010 plus 1 at some instant. And then that's fed as input. And that's going to mess up our calculation and produce very unpredictable results that are crazy. There's another issue, which is that we're going to have sort of halfway voltages. That I said that the 0 and 1s are represented as a voltage. And like we might say, 3 volts is 1, 0 volts is 0. If we're at 1.5 volts, that doesn't definitely mean 0 or 1. And different parts of this logic might end up interpreting it differently. And it's very hard to predict. It's not something that hardware designers intend the circuit to be used in. And they generally won't tell you what it will do unless you really, really need to know. So this is not a stable circuit. And it's because we see the output changing and we're going to act on those changes. So we're never actually going to get to a stable output. So generally, we're not going to build circuits where we take some logic and wire the logic back to itself directly. That can't work. So we're going to have to do something else, because we do actually want to be able to build something which counts up a value. That's an important thing to have. So we need a place to store values safely. We can't just have it on a wire, because that's not a safe, that we're using as input for something else, because we can't have the value be changing. So we're going to have some extra elements in our circuit to buffer values, so we can know then when things change, so we can control when things change and get rid of these transient inputs. We don't want to add one circuit to be outputting something crazy and have us use that crazy output. We want to always wait for it to stabilize. We want to give it an output which has stabilized, give it an input that has stabilized. And we'll talk more about this later. So the basic fix is that we're going to add one of these state components, something that stores a value. An example here is a register. So what the register is going to do is at certain points in time, it's going to read a stable value from its input wire here, and it's going to change that to the value it's outputting. And it's going to do this in such a way that we're never sampling a value which is transitioning between two values. It's always going to sample a value that is stable and then start outputting a new value and wait for its input to stabilize again before we read the next value. And the updates are going to be based on a clock signal, which is another wire I'm not going to show and generally will not show on any pictures. But this is how we're going to avoid seeing those transient states. Okay, so that's circuits. That's our intro to circuits, so we'll talk a lot more about circuits later. And let's move on to talking about memory. So what is memory? What's anyone have a short explanation of what memory is? No? Okay. So the simple idea, way to think about memory, is just an array of bytes. Just a big array of bytes. So we have addresses, which are indexes into that array, and every entry is a byte. So one thing that's going to come up a lot in this class is endianness, which is about how we interpret things like array of bytes when we don't want just a byte. So for example, here's some C++ code, which takes a pointer to 42000 and tries to get an int from it. An int is going to be 4 bytes on our machines. So we don't want to just read this 0. That's not the answer there. We're going to read 4 bytes, starting with 42000. So we're going to somehow take these 4 bytes and turn them into a 4-byte number. And we have 2 options on how to do that. So one option is we can decide that the lowest address goes in the least significant part of the number, that it's the part which affects the value the least. Another option is that the lowest address goes in the most significant part of the number. It affects the value the most. So this first option is called little endian. We use the least significant part first. The lowest address is least significant. The other option is called big endian. The largest address is most significant. So the general rule in this class is it's always little endian. That's because x86 has chosen to be little endian. There's not an inherent advantage. It's just what we're using in this course because it's what x86 uses. So when you need to interpret this set of bytes as a bigger number, you just take the lowest address, whatever has the lowest index, and use that as the least significant part, which when we write a value ends up being the furthest over conceptually at the end of the number, just because our natural writing system uses big endian, basically. So I'm bringing this up now because it's going to come up over and over and over again in this course and will be a source of errors on exams all the way to the final. I hope you can avoid that. So we'll hopefully bring this in. You should remember how this works. Another important thing I'd like to note is that we have endianness at all because I have to decide of these 4 distinct values, how to turn them into a bigger number. If I have a bigger number, I do not have endianness problems. If I have a register that stores a 4-byte number, I do not need to worry about the order of those bytes because the register has a number already and it has a defined idea of what the most significant bit of that number is already. We don't need to set it. We don't need to change it. There's no endianness to worry about. Endianness only comes up when we have multiple distinct pieces we need to combine something bigger. So a big confusion people have is they think, oh, I have a 64-bit register that must have some endianness I need to worry about when I read it, but you don't, because the instruction is say add. It adds two 64-bit registers, it's already treating it as a 64-bit number. You don't need to decide how it does that, that's already been decided for you. There's already a decision about what's most significant, and that's embodied in how add is implemented and how you've stored values already. It's only when you're converting from memory into that register that you need to worry about how do I take the bits of memory, which are single bytes, and put them in the register. Which part goes in the most significant bit or not. So any questions about endianness? Okay, so hopefully you'll think of questions later. So as I said, this is a constant source of confusion and mistakes in this class. And you should remember, when in doubt, it's little endian, because that's what we're using all the time. So if you need to make this decision about how do I interpret these bytes as a number, lowest address, least significant. Okay. So there's one more topic I'd like to talk about, which is a little bit about parallelism and performance. So I mentioned earlier that one of the biggest things we'll be talking about in this class is parallelism. And the reason why is that hardware is parallel by default. When I have that bundle of wires, each wire is going to propagate a value. I don't do it one at a time. If I have a piece of logic that takes a value on its input and another piece of logic that takes a value on the input, those both work at the same time. The hardware computes those 2 values at once. We actually need to do extra work to make things seem to happen one at a time. So hardware is just inherently parallel. And much of this class is just going to be getting the most out of that parallelism. And one thing I'd like to talk about is how we reason about performance when we have something like parallelism. So parallelism makes things a lot faster. We can speed things up by a lot. If we're executing five instructions at once, that's five times faster. But there are bottlenecks, and this really matters. So let's say I have a red task, a green task, and a blue task, and I figure out how to parallelize the blue task. And somehow I can do five parts of the blue task all at once, so I can speed up my program like so. So this is time going forward. I run through the red thing, then I do five blue things all at once. It takes a fifth the time to do the blue things. And my program did not get five times faster. Got a little more than twice as fast. And that's because I have these non-parallel pieces. The pieces I couldn't speed up. This is a general thing which is going to happen when we need to optimize programs. And it gets worse, the sort of regret you're going to have for the effort you spent making things parallel is going to get worse and worse the more you do. So here I've done a whole lot of extra work, and now I'm making the blue part 10 times faster. And I've gotten much less than a 2x improvement. I got 50% improvement for all that extra work. And this is going to matter to you because it means that maybe you should think about, rather than making the blue part twice as fast again, maybe making the green or red parts faster. And you should realize when you approach a problem where you want to make things faster, including designing hardware, that you're going to need to deal with these pieces which look trivial at the beginning but are going to become bottlenecks. And this phenomenon is known as Amdahl's law. So there's a formula in the textbook. You don't really need to know it, but maybe it will help you understand it. And the key idea is that the benefit of any speed up you do, parallelism like speeds things up by splitting it into pieces and doing them at the same time, is going to be limited by whatever your non-sped up parts are. And this means that quickly, those non-sped up parts become very significant. That, sort of the formula version is that we have some serial part, and that serial part factor remains no matter how much parallelism we do. We can reduce the parallel part down potentially very, very close to zero, and all that's going to do is going to make us care more and more about whatever serial part, whatever part we didn't speed up yet. As a programmer, this matters to you because it affects where you should spend your time. As a hardware designer, it matters to you because it means that things that you usually wouldn't worry about, like how fast registers are going to be a big issue eventually. They're going to limit what you can do. Okay. So any questions about Amdahl's law? Okay, so I'm going to move on to the logistics portion, which I'm sure you've all been waiting for. So this is the first lecture. We also have things besides lecture in this course. So there are going to be quizzes. Quizzes are online off the course website, which is linked off Colab. There's a tab on the top labeled quizzes. There will be quizzes pre and post each week of lectures. For the pre-quizzes, you will need to do reading from our textbook, which you should have a copy of. This textbook. If you don't have a copy of it, you're going to have a bad time in this course. There will also be labs. Labs are on lab days, which are Wednesdays. You should be signed up for a lab, or else I don't know how you signed up for this course. They are mostly graded on effort. By effort, I mean we're going to look at what you submitted and decide, is that some reasonable amount of progress? We need to draw a line somewhere. So if you submit something in from lab which is basically very little extra from what we started with, you're probably not going to get credit. But if you make reasonable progress, you should get full credit for the lab. The labs also introduce homework assignments. So many of our labs are followed by a homework, which is just extending what you did in the lab, which gives you extra motivation to make an effort in lab because that's less time to spend on the homework. And also time you can spend effectively on the homework and get help from your lab mates and TAs. Homework assignments will generally be due at noon on a lab day. Except when otherwise noticed, we might have some weird scheduling things like at the end of the semester. We'll also have some exams, which will be two midterms in class and a final in some to-be-disclosed location. We will probably combine the finals of the two lecture sections. I'm going to see about getting that happening. Finals are generally multiple choice short answer, so fairly straightforward. We have finals from the past, which should be kind of representative of what we'll give. Finals and midterms from the past, to give you an idea of what they look like. So I mentioned quizzes here. As I said, they're linked off the course website, which I might show you in a bit. So there's a pre-quiz on reading, which will be released by Saturday evening, and due Tuesday at 10:30 a.m. It's 10:30 a.m. because the first lecture is at 11, and I would not like people doing the quiz during my lecture. Pretty distracting and probably not good. There will be a post-quiz released Thursday evening, starting with this Thursday evening. There was one today. And due the following Saturday at 11:59 p.m. So quizzes are online. They're open book, open notes. They are not open IMs, etc. They are individual other than that. And we will drop the lowest 10% of quizzes. This should give you some leeway if you like have to travel or something like that, so it's hard to do a quiz. But if you have other, if you really need accommodations, you can talk to us and we'll see what we can do. And the first quiz is tonight. It should be pretty short. The main reason I have it is to make sure you get used to it. I might not count it because of adds and drops. We'll see. But the main reason you should do it is because you better make sure you can take quizzes or else it will really hurt you later in the course. Yes?
On the quiz page, it says the time limit's 1:30. Is that 1 minute 30 seconds
or 1 hour 30 minutes? 1 hour 30 minutes. So our ordinary time limits for the first quiz has a longer time limit, but ordinary time limits will be 1 hour 30 minutes for a pre-lecture quiz, for the pre-week quiz, and 1 hour for a post-week quiz. The pre-week ones are longer because you are allowed to like do your reading during the quiz if you want to do it that way, even though it's probably better to read beforehand. Yes?
Are the slides online?
Yes, the slides will be posted. Next slide, actually. I will post copies of the slides and copies and a recording of the lecture. For both lectures, they'll be online, and that means if you don't want to attend lecture and think that's good enough, you can do that. I don't recommend it. Yes?
When you say open book, does that open slides too?
Yeah. Yes. Sorry? The midterms will not be cumulative, the final will be. Other questions?
Are there answers to the past quizzes?
There are answers to, I don't have the answers for last semester's quiz up, but answers to prior semesters are linked off the resources page on the website. So I think they're there. I think if you press a button, I think it does, I'm not sure. I can, if they aren't there, you can ask someone during office hours and we can figure it out.
Are the quizzes on multiple choice or students?
They're all, the quizzes?
Yeah.
They're mostly multiple choice.
Okay.
They're auto-graded. They're completely auto-graded.
Okay.
You should get instant feedback.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you.